Hi, my name is Stuart Weems and welcome to the Investopoly podcast. My goal is to share easy to understand, evidence-based, holistic insights to help you master the game of building wealth. And in today's episode, I'd like to talk about the property market, specifically the last 20 years compared to the previous 20-year period, and pose the question, is the property party over? So over the past two decades, the average growth in median house price across the five capital cities has been 5.3% compounding. That's the last 20 years. The previous 20 years, so 1983 through to 2003, the median house price across those five capital cities grew at 8.7%. So it's a pretty substantial differential there, 3.4% differential. The period between 1983 and 2003 and the period between 2004 and 2024. And so what I'd like to do is explore in this episode, you know, what may have contributed to that performance differential, and is 5.3 or 5-ish percent, is that the new normal? And if so, what should we do about that as investors? Or is it just the fact that maybe the last 20 years has been underperforming and maybe the next 20 years will be better than the last? Now, just to illustrate the big impacts, you know, if you earn a 5.3% return on average over a 20-year period, your property will be worth 2.8 times its original value in 20 years' time. So if you buy for $1 million, it'll be worth $2.8 million in 20 years' time. Not too bad. But if you compare it to 8.7%, which was the previous growth rate between 83 and 03, it would actually be worth 5.3 times. So that, let's call it a relatively small differential, you know, that 3.4% difference in growth rate actually makes a huge difference in, you know, the amount that your property will be worth in 20 years' time, and especially 30 years' time, and particularly in a dollar value perspective, you know, is because if you look at, you know, what's an extra two times, you know, my property doubling in value, for example, it's pretty significant, right? Now, I've included a blog on the website. Of course, there's a link in the show notes to the table that looks at those two decade periods, you know, again, 03 to 23 and 83 to 03. So those two 20 year to two decade periods. And it's actually, whilst I've looked at the average and I said, you know, 5.3% for the most recent couple of decades, 7.8, as I've already mentioned, and that differential's, you know, significant. The differential in Melbourne and Sydney is much more stark, and the difference is almost 5% in terms of growth. So Sydney and Melbourne did around 10% between 83 and 03, and around 5% between 03 and 23. So again, twice as much growth in those capital city markets compared to those other markets. Now, it's important to point out that inflation will account for some of that difference. So, you know, according to the RBA, the CPI, the inflation index, averaged around 4.1% in that sort of previous two decade period, so from 83 to 03, whereas the most recent two decade period, it was 2.7%. So roughly around 1.3%, or maybe about 40% of the differential is due to inflation and a change of inflation. And so we really need to look at what real value, so that is what growth we have enjoyed excluding inflation. That's the most important thing for us as investors. And so when you look at the average across the five capital cities, we're talking about a difference in real terms of around 2%, you know, between those two decade periods. And when you're looking at Melbourne and Sydney, obviously it's a little bit more than that. It's sort of closer to 3.5% in terms of growth differential. Now, it's tempting to reflect on the most recent two decade period and go, well, it's been a pretty tumultuous time and there's been a lot of challenges. So, you know, things like the global financial crisis in 2008-2009, that caused a lot of upheaval and really took, you know, many, many years really for stock markets and financial markets to really recover. And then close on the heels of that was obviously been COVID, you know, the pandemic period, which obviously has caused, you know, a whole host of problems. We're still kind of dealing with, obviously, the inflation impact of that sort of stimulus. However, if you think about the preceding two decade period, it had its own set of challenges, I think. You know, it starts with the Australian dollar being floated in 83, followed by the introduction of capital gains tax in 85. Of course, we had the stock market Black Monday crash in 87, where the stock market dropped 45%, which tends to adversely impact sentiment around property as well. And then the final thing was the introduction of the GST in the year 2000. So it had its own sort of set of challenges, I guess. So I don't know if I could sit back back and draw a conclusion to say, you know, one particular period was worse than the other. I think they had their unique set of challenges, and I'm not really sure you can attribute the differential in growth rates to any of those factors. Now, there's one thing that definitely has added or contributed to the differential in growth rates is borrowing capacity, and that has changed a lot since the early 80s. So there was a bit of banking deregulation that occurred in the 80s to try and open up that sort of borrowing sector. And then we had the emergence of mortgage managers like Aussie Home Loans in the early 1990s that sort of came out to provide that much needed competition amongst the big four. And really, when we look at the early 1980s, the average home loan was around about 2.2 times average income. By mid-2000s, it wasn't uncommon to find borrowers that were borrowing up to 10 times their income. So pretty substantial. Now I'm not saying the average moved to that level. What I'm saying is because of the internet, increased competition, more mortgage managers coming into the market, and them having the ability to come up with policies and products that were different to what the big four banks offered, certainly had a significant impact on borrowing capacity. Now, since then, we've had the Banking Royal Commission over the last 10 years, including stricter borrowing regulations imposed by APRA, with the government regulated body, since 2014. And, you know, things like the GFC occurred, and that had a big impact on loan products and mortgage managers and different opportunities there, most notably low doc loans, low documentation loans, which typically were targeted towards self-employed people that could verify their own income without providing a lot of documents. Now, they never got to the same stage that they were sort of used or misused, probably more correctly, in the US, but they were still pretty common before the GFC occurred. When the post-GFC, you know, those sort of loan products, even, I mean, they're still around a little bit today, but they're not nearly as lenient as they were pre-GFC. So all that has conspired to really contract borrowing capacity. And now today, the average home loan size is about 6.5 times average earnings. Remember, in the early 80s, it was only 2.2. So you could look at just that measure alone and go, okay, so borrowing capacity has tripled over that sort of 40-year period. And most of that change occurred really between 83 and 03, which is that sort of first 20-year period that I'm looking at. Although it's worth noting that there's probably a lot more two-income households today compared to the early 80s. So that would be a contributing factor as well. So maybe it's not three times as much in terms of borrowing capacity. Maybe it's a little bit less than that. But the point is that there was a significant change in borrowing capacity, certainly throughout the 1990s and in the early 2000s as well. And that's undoubtedly contributed towards, you know, much higher growth rates in that two-decade period. Now, I think the long-term indicators or fundamentals for property are really positive. You know, I'm talking sort of 10-plus year kind of indicators. You know, things like population growth, shortage of dwellings, all those sorts of things should contribute positively towards property price growth. But I don't think borrowing capacity is going to have a big impact or contribution. And in fact, the borrowing capacity has really been declining for the last sort of 10 to 15 years. And it's stabilized now, so I don't think it will continue to decline, but I don't think it's going to make a huge contribution to growth moving forward. And I would say maybe that it's probably the biggest contributor to the higher rate of median house price growth in the previous two-decade periods, are from 83 to 03. And really, in a, you know, rising tide, all ships rise. So in a rising market, kind of all properties tend to rise no matter their quality. However, I don't think we're going to be in that rising tide over the next few decades. And so that's something that property investors really need to take into account or consider when coming to implement their investment strategy. And I would probably think it's reasonable to expect that the median house price is probably going to grow at somewhere around 2.5% plus inflation. And so if inflation's around 2.5%, so in the middle of the RBA's target band, then we're talking about a 5% growth rate, which is exactly what has occurred over the last 20 years. Therefore, it's going to mean that asset selection is becoming way more important for investors today compared to, say, 40 years ago. So if you bought a property in the 80s or 90s, really just buy anything, and anything's probably performed well. I don't think you can rely on that moving forward. So then what can investors do, and what should investors do? And I think there's really two things that they can do to make sure that they're being a little bit more active with their property investment decisions. The first one is to be a little bit more conscious of property cycles. That is, choose the geographic geographical markets or the type of properties that you think might be intrinsically undervalued and therefore may be poised to generate better returns in the shorter term as that sort of mean reversion kicks in, which I sort of talk about quite a lot. So I did this analysis on median property data in the five capital cities. And what I did is I looked at the long-term average growth rate, which across most capital cities is around 7 to 7.5%. So that's what property's done over long term, noting that last 20 years has been less than that, and the previous 20-year period obviously higher than that. And so what I did at each quarter, because the median house price is reported quarterly, at each quarter, calculated or projected what the median house price should be today for that capital city. So for example, if I looked at January 1990, I worked out, well, if we apply sort of 7% or 7.5% to that amount or that value in 1990, what should it be worth today in 2024? And so I did that for each quarter over the last 40 odd years and then looked at the average, you know, on average, what should our median house price be, and then compared it to what the current value is. And it won't be any really surprise to anyone, I don't think, but this analysis suggested that the Melbourne house price is about 30% intrinsically undervalued. So that is, if you look at that longer term data, you know, where should it be? And that kind of makes sense given its performance over the last 20 years has been really poor, and the last 10 years probably the worst among the capital cities, as we would expect then some mean reversion eventually to kick in. And Perth is almost 40% intrinsically undervalued. Now, this is not a perfect analysis, of course. This is just really gives us a sense of where property markets are in the cycle. I guess the good news is that no markets appear to be intrinsically overvalued, which is good, but there's going to be some markets that are more attractive than others. And so by investors thinking about that or taking this sort of analysis or intrinsic sort of values and cycles into their decision making, they can hopefully target sectors that are likely to give them better returns in the earlier years of their property ownership, and therefore kind of supercharging their returns. Whereas if you buy into a market after a boom, you know, after a really long growth cycle that may be intrinsically overvalued, then potentially you'll have 10 years of very poor returns, which obviously doesn't help one's investment strategy. The second thing people can do is buy an asset that gives them or lends them an opportunity to really enhance the value of that particular asset. And by doing that, you're not necessarily then reliant just on market conditions to push the price of that particular asset higher. So for instance, you could buy a house or a property that is mostly land value, you know, but has a good dwelling that's in rentable condition. And you could then sit on that asset and then hope the market conditions deliver the return. But if they don't, you know, maybe you could develop that property to actually improve its value. Now, whether that's, you know, bulldoze and build a brand new family home, or just completely renovate the property, or build multiple dwellings on that particular plot of land, you know, whatever that looks like. And, you know, the more potential uses for a particular asset, the more scope there might be to sort of add value. Now, while redeveloping the property might not be your primary objective, and hopefully you don't need to do that and take on that risk or project, it serves as a good kind of backup plan, a sort of plan B, if you like, in case market performance falls short of expectations, and allows you then to sort of manufacture that equity or manufacture that return. And I think property investors would be well served by taking a bit of a more active approach with respect to asset selection. Now, having said all that, of course, the economic fundamentals are strong in Australia, as I've previously highlighted. You know, population growth, housing supply, all those sorts of things. And in fact, it's entirely possible that the preceding two decades sort of performance, you know, between 83 and 03 could actually repeat itself and everything will return to normal and property investors will do quite well. However, I think it's best to kind of plan for the worst in a way and hope for the best. And I don't think I would bank on that sort of period repeating itself. And so I think if we focus on properties that are positioned to add value, buying into markets that we think are intrinsically undervalued by better values type of property, I think investors will be well placed then to protect themselves from underperformance. Okay, so as always, thanks very much for listening. I have a book discount code in the show notes, which allows you to buy a copy of my book for $20, including postage. So if you're interested in that, please have a look at that or share it with anyone that might be interested. And until next week, bye for now.